You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. And I have founded and created the Orthodox Nationalist Lecture Series over God knows how many years. And I'm quite proud of it. And we're going to do another episode today. Believe it or not, we're going to do it on somebody who deserves more attention. You know, my firstborn's name, you know, his middle name is Basil. He's named, of course, after Saint Basil, but also Basil II of Byzantium, who I had in mind as I came up with his name. And it's Basil II of Byzantium and the ideal of the East Roman Emperor. So what we're going to do, or the Empire, the ideal of the emperor and the empire. So, the first thing I'm going to do is deal with this foundation. What is the theological concept of to be, what it is to be a Byzantine emperor at any time? And what Basil II did, given his context. You know, I think of model monarchs in the world. I always think of Alexander III of Russia. I think of Basil II Byzantium right away, immediately. So much of the theological foundation of the Christian emperor, the Christian monarch, came from the great Saint Eusebius. And in particular, his sermon to the Basileus Constantine on the occasion of the 30th anniversary of his reign. Eusebius calls this earthly king an image of the King of Kings, God, but also at the same time his servant. He can be both at the same time. His job is to convert people from idolatry to the true faith at all times. And I think in that sermon, St. Eusebius really gives a summary understanding of what a Christian emperor should be. And this is going to be the dominant ideology of the empire. The emperor is a friend of God, the king of everything, the ecumenical, because he alone is free, or rather, the only true master. He is above money and stronger than passion for women. He suppresses even natural pleasures and curbs irritability and anger without being curbed by him. He is the autocrator, bearing a name corresponding to his deeds, a true conqueror, who has won the victory over the passions that war against the human race. He is imprinted according to the original idea of the great king. And his mind, as in a mirror, reflects the rays of virtue emanating from it. Perfected by them, he is a temperate, good, just, courageous, pious, God-loving, and in truth, the only ruler, the only basileus, a philosopher who knows himself and has studied the external, or better to say, the heavenly sources of every good. This is the basileus who calls upon the Heavenly Father night and day, appeals to him in prayers, extends his desires to the heavenly kingdom. He knows the heavenly blessings are mortal, easily destroyed, flowing like a river and disappearing, they're unworthy of the God of all. He desires the kingdom of God, incorruptible and incorporeal. He prays to obtain it. Raising his mind above the firmament with the heights of his thought, he feels within himself the inexpressible thirst for the light there. For he sees that in comparison with it, all the gifts of this life are indistinguishable from darkness. He sees that the governance of people, their mortal, their impermanent life, the small and short-lived care, care that's little better than that of goats, sheep, or cows, even more difficult and restless than that of other animals. As for the exclamation, the people, the greetings of flattery, they bring more boredom than pleasure to his firm character and truly educated soul. He is not amazed or puffed up by this power, but turns his attention to himself and sees in himself the nature common to all. Now, throughout all of this, Eusebius says praise should be given to God who has given the monarchy to a struggling human race. He is the great high priest of the great God. From him, through him, the friend of God, our Bacchus, our emperor, himself borrows the image of the supreme reign and governs everything on earth, subject to his helm, imitating the all-good. The emperor is a man, really, who has received the wisdom of reigning from above. He leads the inhabitants, the earth subject to him, to the only begotten and saving word, making them ready for the kingdom of heaven. The phrase friend of God comes up over and over again. He's a man who cares about the salvation of each of his subjects. He's a teacher, teaching his subjects goodness, teaches them the knowledge of the God and the great King, and dedicates his royal soul and mind devoted to God, to the King of all, the Creator of all. This was the dominating concept of Christian monarchy from the reign of Constantine to our present day. It's a very, very, very high standard. Now, some might say, what happens if the emperor is not like this? If he doesn't possess these virtues, he doesn't recognize the Heavenly Father. If he has, quote, replaced royal meekness with the irritability of a wild beast, generous disposition, the incurable poison of malice, prudence with madness, intelligence and wisdom with the most hateful stupidity, from which, as a bitter moisture, harmful plants grow, the dissolute life, covetousness, murder, theomachy, and piety. Now, if we could come to a rational conclusion that the emperor has become like this, this is what Eusebius says. Even if he sometimes exalted himself to tyrannical power, he cannot even be called Basileus. How could he bear the heavenly image of the monarchical right, when in his soul he has imprinted numerous images of demons? What kind of leader and ruler is he over all, when he has attracted countless cruel despots to himself, when he is a slave to shameful passion, a slave to depraved misogyny, slave to unjustly collected money, irritability and anger, slave to fear, horror, demons breathing murder, a slave to the murderous spirits? It was very clear the difference between the two. One who has seized the royal power but doesn't have the capacity, doesn't have the qualities of soul necessary for a king, he cannot be called the emperor. Distinction made by the great Eusebius Pamphilius between the legitimate emperor and a tyrant, and later found support in Byzantine thinking. And the church fathers back, you know, he is a church father, of course, but The patristic tradition backs him up 100%. St. Gregory the Theologian, one of the best, expressed his views on imperial power and tyranny. And he was talking about, of course, his denunciation of Julian the Apostate. And he says precisely this. I'm not going to get on to repeat it. Eusebius just said it. Wouldn't be an exaggeration to call Gregory's central thinking the loss of royal legitimacy by Julian in particular as a result of his apostasy and his evil deeds that followed. St. Gregory calls Julian a tyrant. In Greek, this term, regardless of its possible etymology, referred rather to the way in which supreme power was obtained than the forms of its implementation. The tyrant is associated with a negative type of ruler. He is cruel, he is depraved, he is immoderate, he is money-loving, and all the rest. In Byzantine literature, the word tyrannos, or tyrant, is contrasted with the royal dignity not only of a good Christian king, but also of Christ himself. In the Constantine era, the opposition king versus tyrant was clearly defined and clarified by people like Eusebius, considered the author of the famous concept of royal power, as we've said. Eusebius explains that every true state is linked to a specific religion, and it is, of course, Christian. Christianity is the destiny of the empire. The empire is an image of the kingdom of the Heavenly Father. However, Eusebius, in essence, cannot be called the inventor of this teaching by any means. The idea of the divine destiny of the empire was at that time considered self-evident by many. The emperor who assumes the image of that friend of God, whom the soul, the early Byzantine, so selflessly sought. A non-Christian emperor, according to this idea, it was also expressed by Eusebius, but everyone else too, by definition is a usurper. Illegitimate ruler, a tyrant. He cruelly opposes his tyrants, oppresses them, enslaving them to demons, obeying his passions, concerned only with his self-interest, not with the interest of the state, of course. A tyrant is necessarily a persecutor of Christians, and as such, an enemy of the church. So tyranny, by its very nature, opposes the concept of the Christian emperor, empire, and although may imitate it. The struggle between a true Christian emperor and a tyrant is a religious war. It's a religious war in the sense of a struggle between God and the demonic powers. Curiously, the Byzantines called iconoclast emperors tyrants. The concept of tyrant and tyranny were already used in Constantine era, in the sense of very specific, specialized terms, were not simply common swear words. St. Basil the Great gives an almost canonical definition of a tyrant. He is an impious king. He's no longer a king, but a tyrant at that time. But the will of the emperor is an unwritten law that requires a responsible attitude towards itself. The king who autocratically and despotically controls the life and death of his subjects, guided only by his own desires, is a violator of that law. As he transgresses, does not justify the measure of responsibility. Therefore, according to most of the great saints of this era, the defeat of the Byzantines in warfare and the death of, for example, Julian the Apostate, these are punishments for wickedness. Now, Julian's tyranny, Julian the Apostate did quite a bit to define the conceptions that we're talking about here with what a Byzantine ruler is supposed to be or any Christian monarch is supposed to be. It's not only manifested in acts of violence, although, you know, these are defining and characteristics of it. The ethical assessment of the monarch also has to play a role. The issue is not so much, not only whether Julian is good or bad from a moral point of view, but rather in his violation of a certain decorum, norm of behavior that the Byzantine sovereign. So cruelty, treachery, fortune-telling, commitment to sacrifice, witchcraft, magical practices exposed to threat the spiritual climate of the empire. In the early Byzantine world, and Gregory the Theologian in particular, this was the antidote to tyranny. Curious, as I mentioned, the criteria for assessing the essence of state power are quite specific. Constantius, despite his patronage of the Arians, and a very serious abuse of power at the local level, is not considered a tyrant by Gregory. For Gregory, a tyrant is, first and foremost, a king who allows power to be distorted through apostasy from the true faith, severing the very walls of the empire, its connection with Christianity, and depriving the state of its ultimate goals, soteriological goals. Gregory, like Eusebius, does not invent any new doctrine. No new concepts are created. His system was a normal and regular concept of his era. The difference that he was the one who had to express it directly. Eusebius spoke of tyranny mainly in retrospect, or as the theoretical possibility. Gregory pointed to the form of the actual embodiment of this tyranny in the life of the empire. Many writers, both Greek and Russian, will say that Gregory is a central thought for the loss of royal legitimacy by Julian as a result of his apostasy and the evil deeds that he followed. So early Byzantine political thinking. And I think this was the case continuously, with modifications, of course. Gregory the Theologian was a major part of this. As I mentioned, it's curious, the criteria for assessing the essence of state power are very specific, as I mentioned. I've been reading many sources, mostly in Russian. I came across Alexandra Tchikalova, who did most of her writing under the Soviet regime. And I found her very interesting. She died in 2017. Her conception of her interpretation of Byzantium, the emphasis of the divine origin of imperial power, the question of faith, so hence it's theological and philosophical. The idea of the emperor as God's anointed is only one aspect of the rich spectrum of perceptions of imperial power, ranging from recognition of its divinity to ideas of tyranny. So at the same time, an important place in the concept the sovereign was occupied by the attitude towards him, and the basis and guarantor of the well-being of his subjects. She agrees, like everybody, that Eusebius was the main founder of Byzantine political thought. Eusebius of Caesarea, Eusebius Pamphilus, the same person. He has several different names, actually. He was the main ideologist of Byzantium. And the main thing in imperial power was not so much the divine origin, as I mentioned, but how it actually functions. There's someone else that doesn't get much attention. The bishop, Synesius of Cyrene, ancient Libya. He expressed something in 399 AD in his speech on the kingdom, and it was addressed to the Emperor Arcadius. Synesius was very clear. The most important thing is that the king function properly. In God is not his stature or his class, that he is good, is what I mean. The most important thing is not his power, but his concern for people. Concern for subjects, not a passive love of humanity, but as an active activity, I should say. That's what Synesius talks about. Any monarch has to be diligent in caring for the welfare of his subjects. Any true sovereign, you could characterize them with prudence, moderation, justice, self-control, concern for his subjects. And those all go together. Synesius also says that any monarch has to be exposed and taught true philosophy and education, philosophy and theology. As I've said many times before, it goes back to Aristotle. The difference between a good and a bad state, whichever state it is that the one serves the common good, the other serves his own good. Theophylact Simocata, not Theophylact of Aurid. Talking about the Emperor Tiberius in a speech given before the proclamation to the new Emperor Maurice, he says this. Actually, this is to be found in the history of Theophylact. I'm sorry. He doesn't say it himself, but he repeats it positively. This is what Tiberius says to the next emperor, which would be Maurice. Inexorable thoughts about the state took possession of me, for the matter was not only about preserving power entrusted to me, but also about passing this heritage, as it should, into the hands of others. It's necessary that subsequent rulers be better than their predecessors, that they may correct what was wrongly committed by those who ruled before them. Otherwise, all state power will be destroyed, since the foundation of the empire will be weak. You, Maurice, you make your reign the most beautiful epitaph for me. Adorn my tomb with your virtues. Do not shame the hopes of those who believe in you. Do not belittle your merits. Do not humiliate the nobility of your soul. Keep the tyranny of your power in check with reason. Steer the ship of your empire with philosophy as a rudder. Imperial power is a lofty and sublime thing. It gives its possessor the opportunity to boast and become proud in his thinking and his actions. Beware of thinking that you surpass everyone in intelligence. The fate and fortune have placed you above them all. Strive to learn not to fear the favor of your subject. Let justice always be before your eyes, which will reward us according to our deeds. Being a lover of wisdom, consider this purple. Now, of course, the purple is in reference to very rare the color, being born in the purple, being born into the royal family. Anyway, consider this purple to be a cheap rag in which you are wrapped, and the precious stones of your crown are no different from pebbles lying on the seashore. That's the wise and just Basileus. The subjects back then, of course, not today, but back then, subjects of any empire look to their leaders in the same way that the dummies look at athletes and singers and role models. They looked to the rulers. That's why being an icon of Christ was so essential. It wasn't a passive thing whatsoever. In other words, leaders should be more prudent than their subjects, and be so that in proportion, as they surpass them in power, they should also be distinguished by moral virtue. Like Eusebius, Simulcata, in his speech to the Emperor Justin II, to Tiberius, calls the emperor a father of his subjects. The earthly kingdom, an image of the heavenly, tinged with, and this is, and you know, I think some of you have noticed some of the stoicism here that could be found. That's not an incorrect conclusion. He says this: see, God exalts you. This image is given to you by God, not by me. Honor him as you were honored by him. Do not rejoice in the shedding of blood. Do not be a participant in murders. Do not repay evil for evil. Be as attentive to everyone as to yourself. Remember who you were, who you are now. All those present here are your children and servants. In the faces of those present here, you should see the people of your empire. There's a lot of very modern sounding concepts here. Remember where you came from, essentially, is what he's saying. But never deny that the church saw, the Orthodox Church never saw the emperor as a layman. I think he was ordained a reader. And as such, he could be excommunicated for canonical and any other violation, for grave sins. And there's plenty of them, plenty of examples like this. Examples of servility and indulgence of church representatives to the imperial will are equally as numerous. Only the iconoclast emperors in the first period of iconoclasm, Leo III, his son Constantine V, Copronymus, attempted to present themselves directly, unambiguously, as high priests. Even back then, the concept of the restrainer against evil, whether it be Satan himself, the end times, or anything. Evil in general. The empire is the restrainer. Mentioned by the Apostle Paul in his epistles to the Thessalonians, 2:7. So John Chrysostom said, some believe that this should be understood as the grace of the Holy Spirit, while others believe it refers to the Roman state. I agree with the latter. When the Roman state ceases to exist, then he, meaning the Antichrist, will come. And rightly so. Because so long as the state is feared, no one will soon submit to the Antichrist. But after it is destroyed, anarchy will reign, and he will strive to seize power, both human and divine. Concept I find very interesting. John Chrysostom says, you know, he's gonna try to seize divine power to make himself be the counter logos. Let's talk about Basil II. I wanted to, you know, human beings, obviously, especially when they're given that much power, are not perfect. And as we've read, you know, these rulers really struggle. Unless you were just a completely sociopathic tyrant, power is nothing but a problem. Basil II, who was born in 958 and died in 1025, right at the height of Byzantium. So the death of the Emperor John, the Minskis, paved the way for the rule of the Emperor Romanos II and his sons, Basil and Constantine, who were then 18 and 16. dual power is usually a disaster, but it wasn't a problem here. Constantine didn't want anything to do with the state. No, this should be, it should go to Basil. The idea of the Bulgar Slayer, which is one of his titles, I think was something immoderate. We'll get to that here in a second. But he was very impressive early on, decisive, collected, courageous, very energetic, but inexperienced. And he had a lot to deal with. Anytime a young man comes to the throne, you have an army of, first of all, you have a bunch of people who are resentful of this, and an army of people who have an, actually, you know, some kind of a claim to it. You know, brothers and uncles, etc. Now, he is of the Macedonian dynasty. He recalled his mother, the former queen Theophano, from exile, but barred her from state affairs. Remember, Basil was always a bachelor. And afterwards, royal wives played a very insignificant role in Byzantine politics. No coincidence there. That was not the case earlier on. He had blue eyes. Everyone who described his appearance said that. He was very upright. He had a physically strong. He was an excellent horseman and swordsman. Remember, he was on the battlefield. You know, back then this was common. They were on the battlefield with their men during wartime. Now, one of the reasons I say he's a model monarch comes from the slogan that I've always said 100 times. People who know me know exactly what I'm going to say here. Any society, whether it be a state, a nation, an empire, in other times these are different things, they really only have one choice to make, either monarchy or oligarchy. And we know that the oligarchs will do anything to maintain their hold on their lands and their monies and their women. They'll make alliances with anybody. Almost right away, he was faced with a rebellion. Bardas Skleros, who was a legitimately very powerful general, who was extremely wealthy. He was a favorite of the army. And he had a legitimate claim. And he led the wide-scale Asian rebellion against Basil II from 976 to 979. The Scleroi, that family, the cult, that family owned enormous estates to each eastern outskirts of Asia Minor. When Basil II was became king, Skleros came to an agreement with the local Armenian, Georgian, even Muslim ruler, who all vowed to support his claim. He stirred up rebellion among his relatives and adherents in the Asian provinces. Caesarea, Antioch, most of Asia Minor. It's not that this man would have been some, well, he would have been an oligarch. I mean, he was the head of the oligarchy. And hence, you know, he would have been a bad ruler. He was concerned with his lands, not with the empire, although he won many battles. So now you have an oligarch that's actually very competent. He made sure that those around him, of course, were obviously competent, but didn't come from any of these powerful families. There was another a personality, also named Basil, as well as Bardas, who, you know, if they joined together, they could be a problem. So Basil in 985 was deposed. Basil said that he was directing state affairs for personal gain, which is true. He was inexperienced, but his decisiveness, he rescinded all of his previous orders, awarding titles and ranks. Unfortunately, he even destroyed the church dedicated to St. Basil, which was built with his money. A lot of people didn't like that. An oligarch candidate for the throne then emerged soon after, Bardas Phokas. And he was gaining experience very quickly, Basil II was, in consolidating power. Bardas, as I mentioned, Bardas Phokas, was waging successful wars in the East and inflicted two crushing defeats on the African Muslims. In 983, he helped Saud ad-Dawla Sharif, besieged by the Berbers in Aleppo, escape his mortal danger. In gratitude, Saud handed over his land, much of his, many of his lands with the Byzantines, at least to some extent, protecting his dwindling possession from the Fatimids, eventually swearing allegiance to the Byzantine Empire. Phokas captured the city of Kilias, major cities, the governor of Antioch. Leo was operating successfully alongside him. This is not a good thing for Basil. Antioch was the wealthiest city of the empire. Yes, Phokas had become one of the emperor's closest confidants. He was clearly dissatisfied with his position. Either he believed that he deserved more than he had, or he considered his position precarious. But either way, these criminal thoughts began to brew in his mind. Basil's situation was complicated by the outbreak of the war in Bulgaria, which, of course, he's most known for. And unfortunately, the army under Basil's command was defeated right away. Now it was critical. To add insult to injury, in the spring of 987, unpleasant news arrived from Korsun, the attack of Kherson by Russian troops led by who will eventually become Saint Vladimir. An embassy was sent to resolve the conflict, but the Byzantines unexpectedly encountered an unusual condition sent by Vladimir. Yes, they agreed to peace, but only on the condition the emperor's sister Anna be given in marriage. The ambassadors tried to deceive the Russian prince, but he saw through it and continued to insist on his terms. The situation was critical. The marriage of the Bulgarian Tsar, St. Peter, to the Byzantine Princess Maria, under Romanos I, was regarded as a disgrace. And that had not faded from the memory of contemporaries. We can't get into that years earlier. Peter was an Orthodox czar, albeit in Byzantine mind, a barbarian one. At the time, Vladimir was merely a pagan and just a prince. But he was, focused, very much like Basil II was. He had a large harem of concubines that he brought with him everywhere. Eventually, of course, Phocas was defeated. The height of the apostasy, the emperor under the Church of Constantinople, the patriarch he appointed, Nicholas II, Chrysoverges, voluntarily rescinded the old decrees of Emperor Nikephoros II Phocas concerning the management of monastic lands. Like his great predecessor, Basil adopted much a more lenient policy towards the rights of the Patriarch of Constantinople. Basil was an intense ascetic. His life differed very little from that of a typical monk. And he became emperor at the age of 18, surrounded by rebels, pretenders, enemies everywhere. And the people who were surrounding him, the men who became his enemies, were talented commanders. So, Basil went to his patriarch, and he was an extraordinary man. Nicholas II, Chrysovergus, was an extraordinary man. And he truly sought to centralize the concept of monastic administration of the monastic land. But Basil II had no doubts about the emperor's primary prerogatives in governing the church. Following the example of Saint Nikephoros, he personally appointed patriarchs of their sees. Without his order, nothing could happen in the church. Of course, there was a synod involved. They were obviously given choices Betrayal and perjury among his closest associates hardened his heart, unfortunately. Filled him with nothing but suspicion. Yes, he was not concerned with his personal well-being whatsoever. And this is something, an extraordinary thing for a young man to have to deal with. He cared only for the empire. Even in the way he dressed, was very... he would wear the clothing, but like it's kind of like Alexander III, he would wear the absolute minimum. Even the formal receptions. He had a few pearls, which were used. He was very pious, and the clergy adored him. Basil II was, at this point, fairly popular, and would even be more popular as time went on. Rebellion never stopped, but there was something happening in Macedonia, as I've said. Anytime there was any consideration of the weakness of royal authority, a rebellion would break out. In this case, it was Macedonia. In this case, it was planned and led by the four sons of just a minor court official, or provincial official, I should say, Count Nicholas Komitopoulos. They deposed Arboros, who fled in haste to Constantinople with his eunuch brother Roman. Unfortunately, right at the border, the Bulgarian guard mistook Boris for a Greek because of his clothing, and he fell, struck by an arrow. But then Samuel assumed royal power. 980 to 1014. Now you see very similar, somewhat similar overlap in time frame. Samuel was no ordinary ruler. He created a powerful state centered in Ohrid. He united Macedonia as far as Thessalonica, the old Bulgarian lands between the Danube and the Balkan Mountains, Thessaly, Epirus, part of Albania, including Dyrrhachium, as well as Diocletia and Rhaetia. At the same time, Samuel restored the Bulgarian Patriarchate, which was abolished under previous Byzantine emperor, the Zemitskids in particular. But the resulting state was difficult to associate with old Bulgaria. It was a mixture of many people, and the core of the state was Macedonia, which at one point had been a very peripheral region of Bulgaria. Around 980, it began. Samuel put together a large army to go into Attica, but it was unsuccessful. Basil II did start, ringing up victories, and he kept doing it year after year. River lands that Samuel captured, he resettled them with Slavs. The Byzantine garrisons that were stationed in mainland Greece, used their small numbers, did not like the idea of confronting the Bulgarian. But they weren't able to penetrate into the Peloponnese. Essentially what they did were, essentially annual raids. And this is where the problem was. Two Orthodox emperors, it's a shame. There's always sin involved with these things. But I guess the only way that he could expand is in that direction, in the southern direction. From Philippopolis, in 986, Emperor Basil launched a major campaign. He penetrated through the gate of Trajan and laid siege to the city. The army was not well prepared for this. They weren't prepared, especially for the siege mentality necessarily, against the fortified walls here. Provisions were not sufficient. And then came some intelligence that Samuel was approaching Estradicia with a large army. So the emperor quickly lifted the siege and hastily marched his army home. Following day, when he, one day he, well, August, I think it was August 16th, 986, the Byzantines stopped to rest in a forested area near Vacarila, roughly between Danube and the Aegean Sea. And the following day, the 17th, the Greeks reached the forested valley, Itamon Valley. They were attacked from two sides by the Bulgarians, who had been hiding in ambush. They fired arrows, they hurled spears, hand-to-hand combat, whatever. It was a huge loss for the Byzantines. Almost the entire army perished. Now, Bulgarians actually conquered and actually took the imperial tent and the baggage train and the siege equipment that they had. Tsar Basil II did make it out, obviously. And he was saved by a detachment of Armenian infantry, who sheltered the emperor in the center of their square and fought their way through the dense Bulgarian ranks. Samuel wouldn't stop, and this was a big problem for Byzantium. He attempted to build on his success. He conquered the coastal towns of Drak, all of these major ports. He penetrated north through Serbian lands all the way to Ragusa, the port of ports in the area, in the Aegean. And he was successful. So the new campaign was prepared. So obviously he was not happy with all of this. He began to prepare for a new campaign, but internal unrest hampered his plans again. The 70-year-old, now nearly blind, Bardas Falcons, who had been under arrest until this point, upon receiving the news of his rival's death, decided to try his luck once more. In the spring of 989, he assembled a new army from the scattered remnants of the Scaleros army. No way inferior in numbers and strength to the old one. He declared himself Roman emperor again, even wearing purple boots and walking around with them. He didn't fight the imperial army directly, but he wasn't able to blockade Constantinople. The old commander's authority remained very high. You see, the oligarchy in Byzantium was ultimately the old military landowners. Sometimes their connection to the military was iffy, but a guy like him, he was a different story. He was beloved by veterans. Everyone talked about him, even though he was born into an ancient aristocratic family. He always ate from the same pot as his men. He knew them all by sight. He saw them as equals. A very intelligent way to do it. The emperor's spies, that is, Basil's spies, were unable to penetrate this. The emperor sent an embassy to Phocas, offering peace in exchange for a second highest position in the state. At first, Bardas categorically rejected the offer, but he considered what fate has in store for him in the coming years. He was also concerned about the fate of his men who remained loyal to him during the years of rebellion. Remember, the rebellion was never, it was stopped. But kind of like in the Korean case, it didn't go away. He took the crown off his head and the boots and all that, and he accepted the title of Curio Pilates, the man in charge of the palace. All the commanders of his army's military units would retain their positions and ranks. And the emperor very wisely kept his word. This is the only way that Basil II survived. This is a blind man now we're talking about here. Basil and Bardas actually engage in friendly conversation. He asks the old man for advice, how to maintain autocracy in the country and keep the army under control. Phocas' answer was remarkably simple. He advised setting aside compassion and mercy and imposing order with an iron fist. That's what he was told. The program Phocas outlined to Basil was actually written down. Do not tolerate overly powerful dignitaries. Do not allow any of the major military leaders to possess great wealth. Burden them with arbitrary taxes, thus forcing them to devote all their time to private affairs. Confide in no one and reveal their plans only to a few. And he died shortly thereafter. To some extent, he implemented that advice. Basil II, again, partially because he was a bachelor, he didn't have to worry about that kind of thing. He did everything himself. He rejected advisors in general. He harbored a vehement dislike of learned men, but took steps to develop education in the Byzantine Empire, and especially in the monastics. Clearly, the military aristocracy in general, although there was one exception I just mentioned, they were potential opponents of royal power, and they cared for nothing about the state. He continued the measures of his royal predecessors to limit its power and wealth. Are we really not going to resist, Basil said, the designs of these people? Are we really not going to, are we really going to leave in their hands the property of the poor whom they have dishonestly robbed? He unhesitatingly declared war on the rebellious rulers to eliminate the threat posed to the integrity of the Roman state. What he ended up doing in 996 is that he equalized the rights of aristocrats with those of ordinary farmers, peasants. Classes didn't exist anymore. I mean, they existed informally, but now it was made part of Byzantine law. He introduced new restrictions on the purchase by these lords of land plots from free peasants. This was a big deal. Basil is now the champion of the yeoman. We can't get into the timae system. But all taxes, that the poor, if someone, landlord controls a certain number of peasants, if they can't pay the tax, the landlord has to pay it. And really, all acquisitions made by lords from the poor were deemed illegal anyway. And there was no statute of limitations here. And even more than that, that he extended the state's right to repossess property since the time of Augustus Octavian. Let me read directly from the law here. Since we acquired autocratic power and began to settle disputes between rich and poor, we have seen that the rulers, suffering from a passion for acquisition, find obvious encouragement for their passion in a 40-year period of preservation and try, either through gifts or through inherent power and influence, to somehow bypass this period and then obtain full ownership of what they have stolen. Wishing to correct this evil, to place the current rulers within due limits, and prevent future ones from following the same path, we're issuing this law, after which they will know they will no longer find any assistance in the 40-year period of what they, in Greek, was preservation, meaning being able to keep what they have taken. But that which belongs to others will be taken not only from themselves, but also from their children, from their to whom they leave their property. Now, our state does not abolish the rights of property sanctified by prescription, without consideration, without testing, but out of compassion for the poor and concern for the stability of public order, we order, also out of justice and love, out of a desire to heal the dangerous passion of covetousness, we pass this law. So now every major landowner was an enemy of the state. He was in the same position as Ivan the Terrible. So what did he do? He surrounded himself with talented men of low origin. If they distinguished themselves in the battlefield or in the state somewhere, they were promoted. That there was no title that protected you from a crime, protected you from being prosecuted for a crime. He says, according to the old law, persons who had attained the rank of proto-Spatharius, which was the first of the emperor's bodyguard, or another higher rank, if guilty of premeditated murder, were punished only by the loss of rank and honor, but not by the death penalty. In the future, criminals of this class, if they commit murder or conspire to others for the same crime, will be subject not only to the loss of honor, but also to the loss of their heads. So, he became popular amongst the middle strata of Byzantine society and the lower strata of Byzantine society. And taking the money from, he actually was able to take money from the wealthy. You know, you hear people like Bernie Sanders talking about taxing the rich. Oh, I always laugh at that. Who's going to be doing that? The state that is controlled by the rich? How do you regulate the banks that, in fact, are the ones who regulate the state. Well, when you're a Byzantine emperor, you had that position. You were able to do it. And he strengthened the authority of his dynasty, and he raised the necessary funds to wage further war in Bulgaria and Syria. By the time he died, he left 200,000 talents, gold talent, which was a fantastic sum for the time. Treasures from the Celts, the Arabs, property confiscated from rebels, all were converted into cash. In fact, the royal treasuries were running out of space because, there were no, it wasn't like today where they're just money is just on a computer. They actually were physical things. They had to start, digging new places for them to keep this stuff. So he became a populist, which is one of the reasons I call him a model leader. He focused on action. He didn't like using the legalese, the flowery expressions. He was a true ascetic. He also, like several others, were very popular with his soldiers. He was not above them whatsoever. He and his army marched for miles, endured the heat and the cold, was extremely restrained. And obviously, people didn't dislike people who were weak, but he was right with the soldiers at pretty much their same rank, despite being the emperor, acting as if he's one of them. Now, Basil preferred to operate via ambush during campaigns, sometimes bombarding the enemy with projectiles from afar, which he was always improving as it went on. But there was a social war going on, as well as a physical war going on. But Bulgaria was not an easy nut to crack. In 991, as I mentioned, he traveled through Thrace and Macedonia. 4 years he spent on campaign. Basil only captured a few fortresses. Returning to the capital, the emperor learned from his past mistakes, unlike many. And he was unwavering, and he was focused and determined in every way. Never resting halfway, he made the conquest of Bulgaria his primary goal, and it took him 28 years. And he did it. Basil organizes bases in Philippopolis, Thessaloniki, and Mosinopolis, and he wanted a new war. But Samuel forestalled him, launching yet another campaign into Greece in 996. It went very well for them, defeating a Byzantine commander of their Armenian descent, Gregory Taranita, Battle of Thessaloniki, with his son Aishot captured. Now, here's what happened. It all began when Samuel's daughter fell in love with Aishot and insisted their father marry her. There was no choice. Bulgarian Tsar granted his daughter's wish, and after the wedding, appointed Aishot governor in the city of Drak. As soon as the Byzantine fleet approached the walls of Drak, Aishot surrendered the city, having managed to enlist the local Greek population to neutralize the Bulgarian garrison. Even his wife helped him with it. In other words, when they got married, she was so in love with him, Aishot turned him against her own people. battle at the Spercea River that had swollen due to rains. The two armies were camped opposite each other. And that night, while the Bulgarians slept, the Byzantines crossed the river and attacked the camp. Surprise attack ended with the complete annihilation of the Bulgarian army. Now it's Samuel's time to be barely escaping. Fleeing to the island of Prespont. From there on, everything was in the initiative of the Greeks. From 999 to 1,000 years, I mean, you know, the years 999 or 1,000, the Roman generals, among whom Nikephoros Zephanos stood out, victoriously captured the lands of Moesia and the region around Sophia. Greater and Lesser Preslav, and then even in 1001, Basil himself finally arrived at the Bulgarian front. He invaded the Sirtica region, captured the city, okay, many cities. Servia, S-E-R-V-E-I-A, I should say. Cutting Samuel off from the old Bulgarian lands on the Danube. The Basilists then invaded Macedonia and captured Vodun and other fortresses in Thessaly. By 1002, after a long siege, he was able to force the surrender of the city. See, when his, when the Bulgarians' fortunes changed, all of a sudden you had a great interest in Byzantium. And they started turning on him and going to the Greeks and telling them whatever they needed to know. Now, before we go, of course, I have to talk about the blinding of the Bulgars, which actually happened. It's true. Their commander, Theophylact Bonaitis, sent by the emperor into the city in Strumitia, was ambushed and killed along with many of his detachments. All right. In other words, Basil saw one of his armies, or one of his strong units, totally annihilated. And that's where the 15,000 captured Bulgarian soldiers blinded, leaving one-sided man for every 100 as a guide, and sent it to Samuel. Now that's something along the lines of, you know, Dracu. I think he was wrong. When they showed up, he was there ragged, all messed up, they were broken. These blind wanderers bore little resemblance to his once brave and courageous warriors. Samuel couldn't bear the sight of it. He had a heart attack. He lost consciousness. 2 days later, he died. I think the blinding was a terrible idea. Now, it certainly did happen. There's way too many first-hand accounts. But it is a disgusting thing to do. And he did it because he, you know, his unit, one of his units was ambushed and destroyed. Well, anyway, I think I, other than that, his rule was clearly successful economically, militarily, and every other way. He was a sinner. It's very possible that, that's why Basil was never, canonized, because of that way. That's how he dealt with the Bulgarians. That's how he won. There's quite a bit of, many issues with the Venetians in the West that I've dealt with in other other lectures all over the place. I think that is the reason why hasn't been canonized. He just was too temperamental. But otherwise, he was a tremendous man. He was a great man. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.